Hello everyone and welcome to JFG Tonight. And tonight we are speaking with Ray Fleming. I'm extremely excited because he's got a take on physics that is as revolutionary as I've ever seen. It's amazing. Ray Fleming, welcome and thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, JF. I'm excited to be here and talk to your audience and share
All
what I
right.
know about physics.
Yes, I'm totally stunned by the zero point universe, because I've been following, you know, I'm a biologist and I've been following physics from a distance and looking at some of the discourse that I've seen by physics educators, by scientists who talk on the public space. I've seen some fundamental flaw that I could detect, but not being a physicist, I couldn't call it out. I couldn't say you're wrong. But for example, I've been seeing them for years dismiss the ether theory and say the ether has been proven not to exist. And I felt that there was something wrong there without fully understanding why the Michelson-Morley experiment doesn't show what it shows. I knew that there was something wrong with it because they were committed to it with a kind of religious fervor, a kind of philosophical motivation behind. And I knew that it wasn't rational what they were saying, that because I thought the empty space around us, it must have some features. It carries light after all. I mean, if I can receive the light from the sun, there must be something in empty space that makes it possible. And you totally digged into that branch and you discover incredibly amazing stuff from just thinking about vacuum, what we call vacuum. You call it the zero point universe. And you come up with a theory that is simpler than anything we've heard today in physics, and yet that seems to explain more. It's absolutely fascinating. What launched you on this path?
Well, when I studied physics, I was sort of in the same position. I didn't think the standard model of quarks was right. I didn't think that they got relativity right. I realized that Einstein basically turned space into a version of ether after denying that ether existed. And even quantum field theory, it denied causality, cause and effect, and it made things happen simultaneously when that's impossible. So all of the physics that I studied in my undergrad time, I just knew it was wrong, and I didn't know where to go. And then in 1990, I was introduced to Hal Puthoff, and I started reading some of his papers where he talks about the zero-point field and how zero-point field interactions work. And that's when I decided that it was the area of physics I wanted to concentrate on.
All right. When we talk about the zero-point energy, the zero-point universe, what is it? Is it empty space as I conceive of it in the space, for example, between our planet and the sun?
Well, what Max Planck realized back in between 1900 and 1912 was that any system does not reach zero energy, so there's always energy. And some scientists, the earliest I found to pull the ship was Lorentz, realized that this meant that space itself did not have zero energy, that it was never nothing, it always had something. It had these vibrations, these oscillations everywhere. And over time, people realized that they behave like pairs of particles, like electrons and positrons. And so I decided to take this electron-positron model or other particle pair model and see if I could build on that, see if I could build a physics theory using that as the framework for the medium of light and the medium for electric magnetic forces and the medium for everything else. And so that's when I started doing the research that led to my book, The Zero Point Universe.
So when we talk of these particle pairs, we're talking about, for example, matter and its antimatter counterpart. They are thought of as virtual particles, which would be appearing and disappearing in nothingness, in vacuum. And they would be allowed to appear because of the limits of the universe in terms of observation, the Heisenberg principle, essentially at low energy levels, below a certain amount of energy and time and space, they could show up and then disappear without us observing them, which would be allowed despite the Heisenberg principle. That is, above the Heisenberg principle, those are events we would see, and below it, those are events we wouldn't see. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Basically, the quantum field energy for these particles is the same as the Heisenberg uncertainty limit. So these particles are right at the limit of what we can't observe directly. So we have to make indirect observations in order to understand that they're there. But things like electric and magnetic fields and the transmission of light, those sorts of things show us that it's there. And we just have to understand it better.
Now, I believe that in your theory, so there's the electron and the positron, which is the positron being the antimatter version of the electron. And then there are there other things allowed in your theory, or is that it?
In my theory, I realized that there has to be two basic types of particles, because you have the positive negative charge, and you have matter and antimatter. So you have to have one pair of particles like the electron positron and another one that has the matter antimatter polarity of a proton and antiproton. So I've been able to construct my model using just those two quantum dipoles and not needing anything else. In standard physics theory, they'll say,
oops, we lost contact for a moment. Okay, now we got you back. Yeah. All right.
Okay, sorry. So in standard model physics, they have quark pairs and gluon pairs and photon pairs. But what I found in my research is that I only need the electron positron and proton antiproton pairs to explain everything.
Absolutely, and that's why it's so fundamental to me and a shock that you can explain so much with so little. So let's get started on the structure of the theory. And it seems to me that the place that the Casimir effect plays in your theory is much more fundamental than in most physics book. I mean, I would expect the Casimir effect to be chapter 27, but you start with the Casimir effect as an example model force on which you will base the rest.
Yes. The thing about the Casimir effect, it's the only force that we have where we have a physical mechanism that we understand, that the quantum field produces pressure and it pushes two plates together. And because of that, we have a physical understanding of what's going on. So my idea was to try to extend that to everything, that have all electromagnetic acceleration be due to the quantum field pushing objects together or pushing them apart. And then because the mass in electromagnetic equations is the same as inertial mass and gravitational mass, I working for all those equations.
So the Casimir effect, in terms of how it works, it's the fact that because two plates can be so close together that certain quantum fluctuations cannot appear. For example, a quantum fluctuation that has this length cannot appear between the two plates because it would be stepping over the boundary of the plates, which results in certain quantum fluctuations to happen, but they're all very small between the plates, whereas the natural quantum fluctuations outside of the plates has plenty of space to go on, so all sizes of possible fluctuations will occur. This creates a differential of pressure, and it was originally a theoretical prediction. The idea that the two plates would be getting closer together due to the differential of pressure, this wasn't known experimentally. It was first a theoretical prediction, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was predicted in 1948. And it wasn't until 1996 to 1998 that it was proven experimentally. And the other thing that's important is that it was based on something called van der Waals forces that occur between electric charge dipoles. So it tells us that the ether of space, the zero point field, is electric charge dipoles with positive and negative charge. And as I said, that to me is really key to understanding the fundamentals of the quantum field, and then gives me ideas on how to build from that.
Dipoles are extremely important to your theory. So if I understand correctly, there's dipoles of electricity and magnetism, and then there's dipoles of matter. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. What I realized when I was doing my research is that if we want to understand inertia, we need to come up with an electrically neutral way of understanding inertia that's similar to the electromagnetic field. But we don't have, in normal theory, a neutral dipole. And the only property that electrons and positrons have that form a dipole that's not electric charge related is matter and antimatter. So I started working with the idea that matter and antimatter behave as dipoles. And we can see that because even electrons and protons repel each other, or else an electron would fall into a proton. So
you think that the plus and the minus charges, they attract, so that's why you would expect an electron to fall into the nucleus. You think that what's pushing the electron outside of the nucleus is some kind of matter-antimatter relationship?
Yeah, I think it has to be related to the matter electron are pushed apart.
So we're losing you once in a while. I think we can still go on with the interview, but if you have a means to, I don't know, are you on a Wi-Fi connection right now? If you would have a means to maybe plug into an Ethernet.
I'm using Wi-Fi that's connected to fiber.
Okay. The thing is, Wi-Fi sometimes will pause like this, but it's okay. I mean, we're losing you once every 2 minutes, so I'll let you know if you have to repeat a sentence. I think it's fine if we go. And someone was saying, can you borrow the headphones with microphone? The sound is not the best. I don't know. Do you have a microphone that would be accessible readily? Because people are hearing you poorly.
Well, I can try to get a little bit closer to the mic.
Yeah, maybe that could help. Meanwhile, I will remind our audience, you can send your questions and super chats to our guest and me tonight on Entropy. Entropy is my favorite platform for supporting the show and sending your super chats. Do you like the theory as described by Ray? That is our survey of the night. So the link to Entropy is right below the video. You can also send hyper chats through Odyssey by clicking the support button. Fref has already sent a question, but it's a question that it's unrelated to physics, so I'll keep it for the end. But don't hesitate to send related questions tonight on Entropy or Odyssey. And also, I have put in the links in the description below links to the three books of Ray Fleming, The Zero Point Universe, that is, in my view, a must read. It's a revelation to me. Goodbye Quarks, The Onion Theory, and The 100 Greatest Lies of Physics. You have also links to donations that you can give to Ray, because Ray is a retired professor, and he is running on the support from the public. So if you like what you hear tonight, buy his book certainly and read it. It is fascinating how this gets all explained. So let's test the audio now, Ray. How is it?
Is this a little bit better with the
microphone? Maybe it's a little bit better. I think we'll go with this, and I think people can hear you correctly.
I'll move it closer.
So talking about the dipoles, we have to start with the concept of zeptons. And zeptons are how you call the virtual particles of quantum physics, right?
It would be good to come up with another name for it, because if people think about electrons and positrons or protons and any protons, they get hung up on them having mass and having other properties. But these quantum fluctuations are something more fundamental. They're more elementary. And so I coined the term zepton as an alternative to, if someone wants to use that term, they can, and hopefully it will mean to them that it's something more elementary.
So zeptons would be the pairs that exist out there that are existing under the Heisenberg limit or at the Heisenberg limit. By the way, that's one question that I had left in my mind after reading your book. Do these virtual particles always are at the Heisenberg limit, or is there kind of an infinity of smaller energy levels below the Heisenberg limit?
No, the quantum fluctuation energy is right at the Heisenberg limit. So it's a fixed single energy, but there's a continuum of particles at all possible energies and all possible wavelengths and frequencies. But each one is individually quantized by Planck's constant at that specific energy.
Okay. So if you imagine these zeptons, there would be these pairs of particle and antiparticle that are popping up, unobservable but present under the Heisenberg limit, and they form the mechanism that, in your view, is necessary to explain the transmission of light and the transmission of forces. I would understand it as magnetic, electric, and gravitational, including light also.
Yes.
So
yeah, and actually, yeah,
oh, yeah. I would no, I mean, say go that ahead. The
gravitational.
Yeah, gravitational.
Actually, I'd say the gravitational force is the same as the electromagnetic force.
Yes.
And the reason that physicists have said that there's no cause for gravitational acceleration is they never bothered to figure out the cause of electromagnetic acceleration. Because once you figure out electromagnetic acceleration, you realize that gravitational acceleration is a subset of it, at least the Newtonian part of it.
That's one thing you spend some time on in the book, just explaining magnets, and it's quite fascinating. Because you have these magnets, okay, they will either attract or repel depending on whether they have a north or south orientation, a like or unlike charge or magnetic charge. And you explain this as you can imagine lines of virtual particles lining up at the extremity of the N part of a magnet or the S part of a magnet. And as these lines spread out into the rest of the universe, if they encounter a like charge or if they encounter a different charge, it will change how the lines will behave. Either they will repel and go into another direction, or they will create a space for attraction between the magnets. All of this being operated by the zeptons, the virtual particles, right?
Yes, that's correct. When we have this quantum field in place, we can start understanding the Faraday field lines between electric charges and between north and south poles of magnets as being something physically real. And that when we have the repulsive lines curving upward, then they're repelling. And so we get repulsion in much the same way we could get repulsion in some versions of the Casimir effect. And we can get attraction between like particles. And it's similar to the Casimir effect, where the quantum field is providing the pressure. And when the pressure is in equilibrium, things don't move. But when there's differences in pressure, they move.
So you would go as far as to say that the attraction between two magnets is a kind of form of the Casimir effect?
I consider it related to the Casimir effect. But it requires a different type of van der Waals force that obeys the inverse square law. And that's something that I have an idea of how to derive it, but I haven't derived it technically well enough to have a published paper on it. So that's something I'm still working on.
And so these ideas of lines of zeptons eventually bring us to your conception of the photon, which is that the photon is not an elementary particle. Now, that's fascinating.
Yes. One thing I realized, in order to explain that a photon produces a rotating electromagnetic field, and it's also polarizable, that means a photon has to contain a dipole. And so I realized that most likely dipole would be a quantum electron-positron pair at the quantum entity, at the Heisenberg entity. It's the same as the energy required each half wavelength of a photon. And I found out later that I found out later that a famous French physicist, Louis de Broglie, had come up with the same idea back in the 1930s.
So basically, instead of seeing a photon as a little particle that is bombarded like a cannonball, you are seeing chains of virtual matter and antimatter particles popping up into existence and essentially creating a kind of railway for the photon to advance into a direction?
Yes. Yeah, there's a central electron-positron pair systems, a series of them. And then from there, they create an electric and magnetic field, which is also made out of quantum fluctuations. So the proton is entirely made of this wave of quantum fluctuations.
So that would explain the traveling of light in a certain direction. Essentially, the light travels in an ether, which is the ether formed by the zero-point energy.
Yes, that's correct. The zero-point field is the ether, the modern ether.
And interestingly, as I was digging through your theory, you realize that a particle is not just a particle, if it's a particle at all, really, because it has a complex relationship with the fields around it. So you have, for example, a negative particle will just be standing there and it will start being surrounded by positive charges, because if anything is varying around that particle, the positive charges will be attracted to the negative charge of the particle. And so a particle always forms a complex system with the quantum field around it. And there's a big question about where the particle begins and ends. You talk of inner shells, outer shells, and essentially you see particle as complex layered material rather than point-like entities.
Yes, as I develop particle theory, and I discuss this more in my recent book, Goodbye Quark-Zeonian Theory, if we treat a proton like a shell of particles at its charge radius, we can get an explanation for all of its properties without referring to quarks at all. And so when I'm, and then if that extends into the zero point field, and the zero point field is where the wave-like properties form, and that gives particles the wave-particle duality.
Fantastic.
But even the particles themselves are like a spherical wave.
There was one thing I wasn't understanding in this whole conception of particle. What is the outer layer and what is the shell? How do these things come to be defined? When you think of a proton, you seem to be thinking that there is a kind of shell around the proton. What is that made of?
Well, the main theory now is that it's made of quantum fluctuations. That's what the mainstream beliefs. And I agree with that. One of the few things I agree with. And because basically when they do experiments with scattering off protons using electrons or other particles, they find it has a radius. And so it has some sort of spherical structure to it that's not explained by three quarks in the middle. And so this spherical structure is thought to be made of quantum fluctuations. So I basically have run with that idea and thought about how is the structure made and what properties, how mass arises from the structure, not from Higgs boson or Higgs ether.
That was one of the most stunning things to me. You have an explanation for mass, an explanation that seems to be kind of emergent from your theory rather than just state, okay, this particle has this mass. You say that, as it turns out, the volume of protons and the space that it occupies, if you calculate the value of the energy that it takes away from the vacuum virtual particles, you end up finding pretty roughly the exact energy that you would expect to be needed to cover the mass of the proton.
Yes, that's correct. And that was an idea that Dirac proposed back in 1930, that electrons and positrons have the same mass because they have to push against the quantum field. And so I decided to do the calculation. And it turns out that if you use the proton charge radius, it works out exactly. You can derive the proton mass as the amount of zero-point energy displaced by the proton.
This is stunning to me. Are there any other scientists who claim that they have some theory to explain how mass arises? Because it seems pretty clear from your model, it just takes whatever would be the quantum fluctuations in that space, and if you remove them, they don't happen, and therefore the particle has exactly that mass. Are there comparable theories out there?
Well, there is the Higgs field theory, but the Higgs field theory doesn't derive it with a single simple equation the way I do. It's much more complex formula. And as far as I can tell from reading the papers on it, it doesn't really explain it at all to my satisfaction. So, no, there's not really a theory that compares with mine.
Now, talking about the Higgs boson, it seems that your theory does not require the Higgs boson. What do you make of this claim that the Higgs boson has been observed? Do you say it's a technical glitch and it's not been observed, or do you say what we're observing is not a Higgs boson, but it's something else?
Yeah, what I'm saying, it's not a Higgs boson, but it's something else. And what I found, it's very simple math. You multiply the inverse of the Klein structure constant times the proton mass and you get the Higgs boson mass. And based on the onium theory of resonant particles, that just means that it's a proton resonance. It's a relativistic proton in some state, possibly with another proton or electron in proton. And so I think it's something of that nature.
Okay. So going back to the zeptons, it seems that you're giving a very good explanation of magnets and electricity, and you are kind of making a parallel. You're saying there is something else that's just like magnetism and we haven't realized, and you call it the matter magnetic field. You are essentially taking the equations of magnetism and saying the same kind of phenomena happens around matter.
Yes, that's true. And it relates to inertia. And that's another problem with the standard model. Newton and Einstein didn't bother to figure out inertia. So they didn't realize the extent of what inertial effects cause. And that you get inertia with a moving electrically neutral body the same way you do is with an electric charge. That an electric charge causes electric charge dipoles, quantum dipoles, to rotate, and the rotating dipoles cause electric charge. So I assume that an electrically neutral body moving causes the quantum dipoles to rotate, and the rotating dipoles cause the bodies to move.
So basically, you can imagine the zeptons around a mass. Something wants to advance in space. It's getting pushed. But to get pushed, it needs to deal with the fact that the relationship between that matter and the zeptons around it, it will need to have those zeptons rotate because it will push in the matter-antimatter relationship, which complicates the movement, essentially, as you would expect in inertia.
Yes. Yeah, basically, as an object moves, the dipoles have to rotate, and that creates some resistance to motion. And the interesting thing is the speed of light in electromagnetic causes is related to the permittivity and permeability of the quantum field. And the speed of light limit is the same for electrically neutral objects. So it must be related to the same constants or an identical constant that's not based on electric charge, but is the same magnitude. And that tells me that you have to have an inertia that's based on a quantum field interaction that's similar to the electromagnetic interaction.
All right.
And that ultimately,
sorry,
and that
go
ultimately
ahead.
Leads to a force.
Yeah, to the inertial force that opposes things in relation to their mass. Pineapple Platypotamus has a question. He says, Jeff, can you ask him what he thinks Richard Feynman was wrong about? I found it amazing in your book because you quote a lot of scientists who in the past have said things that were extremely insightful. It's amazing how you can quote a scientist from the 19th century and he got it right in light of your theory. It's kind of amazing. You also quote Albert Einstein essentially saying stuff that is now being contradicted in his name, such as, for example, acknowledging the importance of ether and even saying that his own theory was presenting his own view of ether. But Richard Feynman, you seem to have high respect for him because he's been a truly original thinker in the development of quantum physics.
Yeah, Richard Feynman is one of my physics heroes, although he left a lot of gaps and there were things that he couldn't figure out or didn't figure out. Now I talked about Feynman in one of my videos where he says he doesn't understand how magnets attract or repel each other, and which was honest of him, although he took a while to get to admitting it. And so that's why I've worked on trying to come up with a theory of electromagnetic attraction and repulsion and acceleration in general that he had never figured out.
All right. So we have our mechanism for light to transmit, essentially not photons, but rather a photon can be seen as an assembly line of zeptons, virtual particles, electron positrons, oscillating, rotating also under the influence of movement. We have a mechanism for inertia, magnets, electrical stuff. And then we arrive at one of the things that is referred to as a fundamental force in the standard model, but that takes a totally different turn in your theory, the strong nuclear force, which amazingly you seem to say is not carried by a boson like other forces. It has nothing to do with it. It is more like the Casimir force. As things get very close, they get attracted extremely strongly to each other.
Yes, that's true. One thing about the Casimir force is it varies to the distance to the fourth power, while normal forces vary to the distance squared. And it means at large distances, the Casimir force is very weak. But at very short distances, it's very strong. And it turns out it becomes stronger than the repulsion between protons at about 3 times 10 to the minus 15 meters, which is about 4 times the radius of the proton. And so it has the same, the Casimir force has the same range and energy as the strong force. And it's a fairly straightforward calculation based on known equations for.
Yeah, so for those who don't know what the strong force is, it's simply the fact that when physicists realized that the nucleus of atoms was formed by protons and neutrons, they realized that there was a positive charge there. And normally, if you have positive charges together, the positive charges will repel each other. And so they had to invoke something that would explain why so many pluses would get together in a very small space. And that's where the strong force was invented, essentially. And the alternative proposed by Ray Fleming here is that if the protons are close enough together, then there will be a lack of quantum fluctuations between the two as opposed to outside of the two. And this will keep them together against the strong repelling effect of the electrical charge that they carry, which is a plus charge. So I find it an absolutely amazing proposition that we may be totally wrong in how we think of the strong force with particles and another field superimposed on the already existing field. And Ray comes here and he says, no, just calculate the Casimir effect and you'll see that it could happen, and it has to happen, in fact, between these two protons.
Yes, the Casimir effect between protons and neutrons has to exist. We know that it's a real force. So even if there are other things going on related to the strong force, we have to include the Casimir effect as part of it at a minimum. And it may completely replace the strong force.
That is absolutely stunning to me because I've seen so much of these graphs of the standard model. I'm looking at this graph, for example, and I was kind of taking it for granted on the basis that I'm thinking scientists will not publish an image like this if each of these particles are uncertain. But here we hear a totally different take, and this has not been taught to me that something else could explain this attraction. And as you show in your paper, the distances are just mathematically compatible. That's exactly where we would expect the Casimir effect to take over the electromagnetic repulsion.
Yes. Yeah, it worked out exactly when I tried it. It was a surprise, but actually not a huge surprise to me.
And
But
then
I
extending,
the funny thing is it's
oh, go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say the funny thing is that I came out with this idea years ago, and it's gotten very little penetration into the mainstream of physics.
Yeah, so I was wondering about this, the penetration of mainstream of physics. You've been a teacher, I understand. Was it at what level was that?
Well, actually, I wasn't really a teacher. I worked in private industry most of my career, although I certainly did some instruction and speaking along the way. But
Okay.
I started out working on nuclear reactors. Then I went to work in a field called X-ray fluorescence analysis, and I did some experimental work with vacuum discharge. And then I worked for the state of Texas, where I worked my way up to the manager of radioactive material licensing.
Okay,
So I spent my career in outside of academia, which has made it even more difficult to penetrate academia.
absolutely. I know how hard it is. I was in academia up to the postdoc level, and I was tired of it. I just had to leave after my postdoc. I decided I'm not continuing as a professor. I published my own theory on Amazon, and it's out there for people to consult. And what I found is that the kind of mainstream is impenetrable. There's a lot of people in there that are just repeating whatever is was the mainstream thought in their time, and they don't quite get informed. They don't quite evolve in their view of science, and it's not true that you can convince them with a good argument. The good arguments stand there in absolute silence, and most of the time you have to basically force them to read it.
Yeah, well, and that's what I'm trying to do with my YouTube channel, is trying to force discussion and force some debate and maybe gain some penetration, or at least get physicists to realize that they need to improve their theories, that they just can't be satisfied with what they have so far.
Yes. Lodazal sends a super chat. He says, what does Ray think of the helical particle wave theory? I barely remember anything about it, but I'm curious. A helical particle theory, I'm not aware of this, are you?
I've read a couple helical theories of the electron, but I think that the evidence is on scattering that it tends to be more spherical. Now, there is a helical thing in terms of any rotating or any moving charge that's creating a magnetic field or through a magnetic field will trace out a helix. And so you end up with helices such as in tokamaks that do fusion.
Very interesting. Okay, we lost you for a while, but you're back. I was wondering about the 90 degrees, talking about helixes. I believe there is a 90 degree relationship between the electrical and the magnetic field as they progress through space. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. In terms of the photon, and you can think of it as a rotating dipole, that the electric field is oriented with the electric charges, and the magnetic field is oriented north south at 90 degrees to that.
Because so I was wondering, for you, who is basically saying Einstein was wrong in invoking space out of nothing, you have to come up with space experimentally or something like space. And I was wondering, is in this 90 degree relationship, is that the beginning of the 3D universe right there?
Yes, you can think of it that way. We certainly have to have, as far as we can tell, three dimensions in space. The dimensions I see arising from the wavelengths of quantum fluctuations, and time comes from their frequencies. And these are also regulated by the quantum field itself, because the quantum field produces torque to regulate distance and time and velocity. And so dimensions and time rates come out of the quantum field. And they're allowed to have three dimensions.
Wonderful. Carlos sends a question. He says, how does such things such as atomic clocks in orbitals explain time dilation effects in gravity fields? That is one thing that is often attributed to relativity. Relativity would explain because the orbital is longer, the thing is going faster. But you have a different take on this, right?
Yes. Well, there's an old theory actually that Einstein started and others have followed up on, that instead of this effect being due to time dilation of space, where some fictitious clocks in space change their clock rate, that rather frequencies of light and frequencies of particles change when they're near large values of matter. And so, and that's more an idea that Newton talked about hundreds of years ago, that the matter, like our sun, changes the permittivity and permeability of space, and so it changes wavelengths and frequencies of photons and other particles, and that changes the clock rates. And it's a strictly an electromagnetic phenomenon It has nothing to do with Einstein's version of general relativity.
So basically, if I understood that part correctly, if you're closer to matter, your zeptons are kind of oriented differently. They work more against the workings of time or the developments of movement, and therefore will slow down any clock. That is what you're suggesting?
Yes. Yeah. When the quantum fluctuations are close to a body like the sun, their rate of rotation slows down. And it also becomes shorter, which shortens the wavelength and also decreases the time, changes the frequency.
Okay, so it's through their rotation that they're kind of sludging it.
Yes. Yeah, it slows everything down because the torque of the quantum field increases when matter is nearby.
All right. Fref has sent two questions. He says, on entropy, our ancestors have been using fire for at least 250,000 years. In this time, women have naturally tended the fire while pregnant. Is the apparent difficulty of very recent modern birthing due to a lack of smoke inhalation during pregnancy? That is a biology question. You know, there could be something like this. I don't think it's totally impossible, but I would find it very weird that that you need the smoke to somehow be successful in an evolutionarily fundamental action like this. But you're not totally out of reality. Perhaps it exists, but I can't tell you. And he also says to Ray, this sounds like the Broglie Bohm pilot wave theory. It was supposedly dismissed by von Neumann, but his math was later proven wrong by a woman. I don't know about any of this. Are you aware of the story he's talking about?
Yes. The Broglie-Bohm theory is an alternative to the Copenhagen theory and the many worlds and multiverse interpretations of quantum mechanics. And what they were trying to do is come up with a physical explanation for what's going on in quantum field theory and have a real physical cause. And so the pilot wave is basically a quantum field type theory based on a quantum field made of quantum fluctuations, although they didn't develop it explicitly that way. But my interpretation of it would be that you get quantum mechanical effects and interactions occurring with the quantum field, which is what causes what we see in things like the double slit experiment.
Yeah, I was wondering about the double slit experiment and your framework. Is that the whole wave particle duality goes off with your theory, if I'm correct? It seems that you've kind of given the true status of wave to everything.
Yes. Yeah, the photon really is more wave than particle. It's only particle in terms of when it gets absorbed, it interacts with a single electron. So when a photon is absorbed, it's absorbed at one point only. Even though the entire time it's traveling as this wave through space.
All right.
And so using that model helps a lot.
And Carlos has a completing question to his previous question. He says, what about, because he was asking earlier about time dilation effects in gravity fields, but now he says, what about time dilation at relativistic speeds? Because I've often seen in mainstream media covering science where they say relativity has been proven because these particles that only last a fraction of a second, if you send them super quick through an accelerator, they will last much longer. And it's taken as a demonstration that there is time dilation and therefore a demonstration of relativity. What do you make of this?
Yeah, the way I interpret it is that you have an object traveling through the quantum field and the quantum field resists its motion. So that resistance causes a torque that slows the rotation and reduces the frequency, which makes the clocks run slower. So I think it's just a simple torque effect related to the object traveling through the quantum field that slows the clocks.
All right. And then the cherry on the sundae, I would say, of your theory is that you come up with an explanation of gravity. Now, that is extremely exciting because I've been waiting to hear one and I've been extremely impressed by yours. You come back to a view of gravity that almost got discarded completely. This idea that the bodies that are being attracted through gravity are essentially just being pushed together. And they're being pushed by a mechanism that is intrinsically tied to your zeptons fields.
Yes, that's true. The theory was originated by Nicolas Fatio de Dyer, who was a contemporary of Newton's, where he realized that two bodies would shadow each other if you had pressure coming from the outside, and so that there would be less pressure pushing them apart than pushing them together, which is sort of like the Casimir effect. But in this case, you have the body is blocking the outside pressure rather than reducing the quantum fluctuations in the middle. And the thing that was missing is you need to have some source of pressure that obeys the inverse square law. The body has to be mostly transparent so that the force is proportional to mass and not to just the area of the sphere. And you have to have no kinetic interaction, no drag effect, no heating effect. But we know from the Casimir effect that we don't have the drag and the heating with the Casimir effect relationship. And we know from electromagnetic force that if we have a pressure force that's responsible for magnets being pushed together or pushed apart, that obeys the inverse square law, and that obeys the relation that it has to be proportional to mass. So once we have a pressure, a quantum field pressure that's responsible for electromagnetic effects, that same pressure is responsible for gravity due to the shadowing mechanism that Fatio came up with.
Yeah, that I wasn't sure I understood. So is the gravity that you suggest a direct analog of the Casimir effect? Why is the pressure coming from outside the pair? I understand that I have two bodies and they will be pushed together. What is forming that increased pressure? Is it quantum fluctuation or it's totally different?
Well, what happens when you have two bodies is that one essentially casts a shadow. The forces coming from one side cast a shadow on the body on the opposite side of it. And it reduces the amount of force that's being pushed against the body. So there's less force pushing them apart than pushing them together.
But is it the totality of all forces? For example, what is being shadowed? Is it the rays of light coming from other stars? Or is it something specific? I mean, is it shadowing the entire part of the universe that it has direct visual access to?
No, it's a shadowing these van der Waals forces or something like a van der Waals force that exists within the quantum field itself.
Okay.
And all the electric charge dipoles are interacting, which causes them to vibrate, and the vibration builds up pressure that pushes on all the bodies, everything all the time. And so when you get differentials in that pressure, you get motion. And so the shadow gravity effect was just one way to get a differential in this pressure.
Now, I was wondering, it was mind-boggling to me. How would you prove your view of gravity? Because in the end, it seems that scientists have become experts at modeling anything with an equation, and that ultimately an equation can tell the truth and another can also tell the truth. and ultimately experiments that can slice between two different views of the world are harder and harder to design. Is there a smoking gun experimentally that one could have that would reveal that you're absolutely right?
Well, that's a tricky question. One of the biggest ones is related to the what I call the matter force that relates to inertia. That inertia behaves like a force that follows Maxwell's equations. And so it's possible with Maxwell's equations, you have something called Lorentz force, that as a body is in orbit, say, Jupiter around the sun, that there's, due to its tangential velocity, there's going to be an inward force toward the sun. And there's a problem in current astronomy where the density of Saturn is half the density of Jupiter. And I think that's because they didn't account for this Lorentz force that arises from this matter force effect, which by the way, it's been called, scientists say, that arises from gravity. And so the gravito magnetic theory is nothing new. I just say that it's actually due to this matter any matter relationship.
All right. Lapitop says, Feynman talked about this theory of gravity and claimed it didn't work. But I believe that Ray's answer to this is that Feynman didn't have all of the tools. He was fundamentally processing the question as a problem of pressure and mechanics, whereas with quantum fluctuations, the heat expected from such pressure and mechanics just doesn't happen, right?
Yes, that's true, because the Casimir effect happens and the plates don't get burned up. So we know the heat theory, the heat problem doesn't happen with the Casimir effect. So as long as we're getting a quantum field pressure, then it works. And the other thing, as I was inferring, is that if the electromagnetic force uses the same sort of pressure that's required for the Fatio-Lesage effect to be correct, then we already have the force. If it works for electromagnetism, then it works for gravity.
Very interesting. I'm skipping over a lot of very interesting stuff in Zero Point Universe, and I highly recommend anyone who's watching this, if you enjoy what Ray is saying, go buy his book on Amazon, The Zero Point Universe. There are theories in there about liquid, fluid stars and how convection currents relate to magnetism. It's absolutely insightful. Carlos has another question. He says, in a double slit experiment, you can collapse the wave pattern by observation. Does Ray have any explanation of this effect?
Yes, and I described it in a recent YouTube video where I talked about that, that if you have an observation of the photons going through the slits, then if you observe it going through one slit, then it has more particle behavior. That once you observe it going through that slit, it went through that slit. So what I, under the photon model I use, what it means is that you have a central electron positron dipole at the center of the photon that's been reestablished at that slit. Because when the photon breaks through two slits, the wave goes through, but the central particle pair doesn't. It doesn't go through one slit anymore. But when you observe it, you produce a new central electron positron pair along the center line, and then it behaves like a photon that went through that one slit. I encourage someone to look up my YouTube video on the Bohr model and the double slit experiment.
All right, you will find Ray's channel. There's a link to his YouTube channel right below the video. Yeah, there was this idea with respect to the double slit experiment, and I think Feynman extended this quite a lot, of multiple paths. It's like quantum particles were thought of as exploring multiple paths and then kind of being instantiated in only one of those paths. The idea of path integrals, for example. Is there a place for path integrals in considering the structure of your Zepton channels?
Well, certainly you can use that type of mathematics to look at the probabilities. What I do is a physical mechanism. I want to understand when is a photon interacting with an electron, because that's when absorption happens, when you get one photon interacting with one electron. And it could be conceivably a photon that's part of the wave that's not in the center of the wave, and which is what happens with the double slit experiment. Once you break down the wave so that you don't have a central particle pair in the middle, then any electron positron can be interacted with an electron to absorb the photon at any point. And so that way you can get a large number of points of absorption instead of just one point in the middle.
Oh, that's interesting. So you can split the photon in some sense. It's not so much a quantum.
Yeah, you really do split the photon in the double slit experiment. It goes through both slits normally.
Very interesting. Pineapple says, what does Ray think of particle spin? Is anything spinning or no?
Well, I have derived this in my particle theory papers that it occurred to me that when the quantum field is getting polarized, including the structure of the proton and electron, that it must rotate in one direction because it takes less energy to rotate in one direction than two. So, and we also have to have a real rotation in order to get a magnetic field. So I think that the spin is a real rotation. And I think it can arise from the structure along the outer shell of the electron and proton. So that's been my working hypothesis on spin.
All right, wonderful. We are headed toward the conclusion. There's still a couple of questions coming in. I will leave a few minutes. But I will also say a word about the book that I didn't read, but I've been surfing over it a little bit, your other book, The Onion Theory. The Onion Theory is meant, if I understand correctly, to completely abandon the concept of quarks.
Yes, that's correct. I began the book with the idea that trying to figure out if it's possible to construct a theory of all the particles, all 500 or so, using only electrons, positrons, protons, and antiprotons. And I used a theory, a relativistic Onion theory, that was discovered by Milne and then Feynman and Sternglass, and then Brown published about it. And so I use that to build up a theory where all of the particles and all the quarks get just replaced by this relativistic Onion theory. And I was able to calculate the mass of all 500 plus particles accurately using that theory.
That is absolutely stunning. I'll be sure to read that. That's very interesting. Now, when you say relativistic theory, are we talking about versions of the electron that are spinning extremely quick? How is it relativistic?
Well, what it is with the normal positronium model, which is onium resonance with electron and positron, there's one solution where they're rotating each other at a normal velocity. It's not approaching the speed of light. But there's a second solution where they're rotating at close to the speed of light. And when they do that, it takes on a lot more energy, around 140 MeV, which is essentially the mass of a neutral ion. And that's what Feynman and Sternglass discovered. And so what we find from there is that there's a quantization of energy due to these relativistic electrons and positrons at the 70 MeV range. And all particles are quantized at that energy range. And so it's possible to build up a model using Onion theory of every particle.
All right. So I guess that this also affects the generations of matter. I've always found bizarre that there was this muon and tau that seem to be extremely rare particles that only physicists work with in the lab. You are also explaining that kind of variations of matter?
Yes. In the theory that I work with, the mu and tau particle are mesons. They're like all the other unstable particles that don't have protons. They're not like the electron. A mu particle is just like a pion, and tau is like something called a d meson, which is a similar energy and range, and similar to decay modes. And so I don't think the mu and tau are elementary particles at all.
All right, that is absolutely fascinating. Chain Reaction says, if the Casimir effect can fight magnetism, how do magnets fight the Earth by staying on a fridge? Guess I'm misunderstanding.
Well, when a magnet's on a fridge, it's being pushed against the fridge by the quantum field. And so that's pretty much all there is. And that force, electromagnetic forces, are much stronger than gravity.
And let's not forget that the Casimir effect will take two plates and put them even closer together. So if anything, the Casimir effect could only help your magnet stay to your fridge, right? The Casimir effect would only be combating an effect like the electron to the nucleus. So it would be keeping, it would be, well, not an electron to the nucleus, but two protons in the nucleus getting closer together. There will be a repulsion, and it's that repulsion that the Casimir effect is fighting. However, you do describe in your book that the Casimir effect operates at a certain range, but that if you dig deeper, as protons get even closer together, then there is a repulsion appearing?
Yes. Yeah, there's a repulsion, and it appears eventually that repels the strong force. And that repulsion is related, we think, to Pauli exclusion principle, and also something called degeneracy pressure that prevents two protons or two neutrons from occupying the same point in space. And that's, degeneracy pressure is why we get neutron stars, that neutrons can't occupy the same point in space, so they reach a maximum density and they're repelling each other. Well, this repulsion opposes the strong force.
All right. Well, I've been extremely impressed by your theories. I have a couple of open questions that I'm curious about. But certainly what you've laid out tonight and what I've read from your book, to me, it's stunning that it existed and that I wasn't aware of. I would have liked to be taught these things in school. I would have liked someone to warn me, JF, there's this guy, Ray Fleming. But someone did, because ultimately an audience member came and told me, JF, you have to look up Ray Fleming, and I'm quite stunned. It's a stunning realization that a simpler model is possible, and we should definitely not give this up, because if you're right about 1% of what you're saying, I think it's a revolution in physics. But when I read your book, I'm afraid that you're not right about 1%. You may be right about 100%.
Well, yeah, maybe. I really appreciate you inviting me to be on your show.
Now, a couple of wild questions. Black holes. Will you have insight into black holes with your theory? Have you started working on maybe trying to characterize the so-called singularity? It does seem that your theory lends itself to a better understanding of what happens inside the black hole.
Well, I do say that singularities can't be physically real. So, and in a theory like I'm developing, there's no space-time curving or contraction. So that type of phenomenon doesn't happen. So basically, we have to go back to an older theory where Black holes are essentially large neutron stars that are so large that light can't escape.
Okay,
And
and
that's what I'm working on.
Carlos says, so does Ray's theory not have neutrons? Well, absolutely not. We just didn't speak much about neutrons, but Ray presents the neutrons as essentially a proton that has received a high energy electron that has joined in and that can decay through, of course, getting rid of the electron, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I basically deal with neutrons as a proton and an electron in the same space where their shells are superimposed on each other.
And people who watch this show have a couple of pet peeves in physics. Among other things, they really like quantized inertia. How does your theory relate to quantized inertia? Because it seems to be an alternative explanation to how inertia comes about.
Yeah, quantized inertia is very different from my explanation of inertia. And as it arises from the Unruh effect based with accelerating objects. And that's I could spend a lot of time debunking it, and I've been thinking about doing a video on that because the way I look at it is that Unruh radiation doesn't exist because the quantum fluctuations don't care if a body is accelerating, so that's 7 light years away. It doesn't affect the quantum fluctuation. So it doesn't convert it to a photon.
Ah, very
And I could
interesting.
go into
So
a
it
lot
se
more detail.
so it seems that the Unruh radiation then relies on this kind of assumption of instantaneous action on space that is present in relativity, ultimately.
It requires an instantaneous action, and it requires that a quantum fluctuation somehow is affected by one observer who's accelerating more than every other observer that's not accelerating. And it just doesn't make sense to me.
Very interesting. Another feature we haven't talked about of your theory is we often hear from the mainstream physicists, they will say particles and light must travel maximum at the speed of light, but space can do whatever it wants. That is a sentence from Lawrence Krauss. You have your own version of this because the fields. The alignment of zeptons in your theory can go faster than the speed of light simply because their full rotation isn't necessary to the development of a magnetic or a matter magnetic field. They can just slightly change their orientation in a line and then influence each other such that eventually the field can reach distances that are further away than would be reached by light at the speed of light, right?
Yeah, that's correct. There isn't a limit, at least it's much faster than the speed of light, for how fast electric and magnetic fields propagate through space. And you can think of it that when a photon gets absorbed, almost all of the electric and magnetic fields are farther than the speed of light limit away. They're outside what's called the light cone. Yet all that energy gets reabsorbed when a photon gets absorbed. So the electromagnetic fields collapse instantaneously.
Does that mean we could have like technical communication faster than light? If I was to induce a big magnetic field somewhere in the universe, I could send binary signals with it?
I think so. I've been working on a theory that I haven't published yet, and actually did some experiments that weren't successful. So I want to work on that some more. But I do think that we can have faster light communication,
All
but
right.
not faster than light moving our bodies faster than light.
Wonderful. Carlos says, so Ray's black holes are Newtonian and without event horizons? I don't think so, because I've heard you talk about the Hawking radiation.
Yeah, no, I follow more of, there was an early theory of black holes called black stars by a physicist Paul Michel, who's very famous in the UK, but not as well known today. And he realized long ago that even classical stars could get big enough that they would hold in all the light and form an event horizon. And so that's what I'm working on. I have a lot of work to do to develop black holes in my theory of quantum general relativity, and that's a work in progress.
And talking about Hawking radiation, one thing I forgot to mention, I was fiberglassed by your theory of beta decay. I believe it's beta decay, where you invoke a kind of Hawking radiation-like thing, but happening inside the atom. So a virtual particle shows up in the same way that one part of that virtual particle would be attracted toward a black hole, but you suggest an analog of this with magnetic charges, and such that eventually an electron is released and a change has happened inside the atom. That was mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, that was one of my better insights when I was writing my book, that you could take a neutron, and if you have a quantum electron positron, the positron side of the quantum fluctuation could interact with the neutron, change it to a proton, and then the electron would be left outside at some distance and with excess energy. And using that type of interaction, you can explain a lot of beta decay and other weak interactions, and you don't need W and Z particles, and you don't need neutrinos to explain them.
It gets so much simpler. I'm amazed. One last question. I'm a big fan of quantum Darwinism because I'm a biologist. I like evolutionary processes. Have you ever heard about quantum Darwinism, and is it compatible with your theory?
Yeah, I know a little bit about it, and I tend to agree what they're doing because one of my mantras about quantum theory is that people forget the universe operates just fine without us. So the universe is always interacting in ways that change the outcome or possible outcome or result in whatever outcome is going to be the result. So that when we have a quantum system, and we are predicting the results, the universe is going to interact with it in ways that we may not be able to predict, or maybe ways we can predict, but we don't want. And I think that those types of interactions are going to lead to effects that they talk about with quantum Darwinism. So that's a theory that I think definitely has some legs and needs to be researched more.
Wonderful. Well, Ray, in conclusion, I will say, and I do have some solo news item that I'd like to cover, so I'll say goodbye to you, and I'll say I'm super impressed, and what should happen is that anyone who's interested in fundamental change in physics should get interested in this book, should get interested in challenging that model, perhaps, or accepting it, but there is definitely something in there that is an increase of insightfulness with respect to anything else we've ever heard from any physicist. And so I find it mind-boggling that this theory isn't being talked about in the mainstream, and I hope it becomes. I hope that the people who are watching us today will take it upon themselves, go send super chats to your favorite physicist, go ask them, what do you think about this theory? Because to me, it's absolutely stunning that the entire standard model will be reduced in complexity by basically an order of magnitude or two.
Yep, that's right. And thank you so much for inviting me, and I appreciate you spreading the word about my work.
Thanks for coming. It was a great pleasure, and I'll see you in the future. Thank you, Ray. Bye
Okay,
bye.
I hope so. Bye.
All right. Well, wasn't that an amazing experience, Ray Fleming? I really have the impression that I am in front of a unique thinker that can change the course of time. That is what I'm experiencing. I am fascinated about the power of this theory, simply the imagination of virtual particles just laying around us and influencing, explaining everything from mass to inertia to the difficulty of movement to even gravity. And I don't know if you guys will remember, but if you are a good fan of me, you will probably remember that 1 year ago or 2 years ago, I said, we have to find a Casimir effect-like explanation for gravity. I am sure that something like this will be developed. Well, little did I know, it had already been developed, and Ray Fleming was already out there talking about it. Well, wonderful, and thank you so much for the user who recommended that I contact Ray. It was really a big revelation. I wanted to cover a couple of news items that are emerging in Canada because I've been following this story for many weeks now. Amalgam Zero says, oh, holy shit. Pineapple says, very nice. DK Shadow says, fiberglasted. Yes, I think it's absolutely fantastic. You know, we've received so much original theories here on JFG tonight. And sometimes they're really crank theories. This is definitely not it. This guy is invoking principles that have been predicting the Casimir effect. You know, the thinking around the Hawking radiation and the whole idea of virtual particles popping into existence and then disappearing has allowed us to predict that two plates would be attracted together if you put them close enough, that there would be a force there. And the fact that we went from theory to experiment on this domain within the space of, 30 years, tells me that there is something deeply right about this thinking and that it should be applied everywhere. And in particular, when Ray invokes a virtual particle within the atom, allowing some of these jumpy events where, okay, an electron gets swapped here, the electron collides with a proton, the proton becomes a neutron because it has ingested an electron, and some electron changes its state. All of this seems to make perfect sense. Essentially, virtual particles as the stock traders of the physical world. It is absolutely stunning. Ottawa, things are looking bad. Full authoritarian crushing by Trudeau. Heavily harmed Ottawa police arrest at least 70 Freedom Convoy protesters. Will run 24 hours a day to clear the city. Rights have been abolished in Canada. People were quoting Canadian tweets that were critical of Cuba for not allowing their protests to go on. It's like, stop with the double standard, Canada. You are oppressing your own people in Ottawa right now. It's not time to be judging other nations. They have arrested the leaders. You know, the lady who was running the Give, Send, Go? Arrested on the streets like that. Another leader was taken out of some home or some hotel room where he was. Taken out, arrested. They are crushing the dissent in these protests. That is what's happening right now. There was also Putin to personally oversee massive nuclear drill on Saturday with tensions on knife edge. The Russian military confirmed on Friday that it will move up nuclear weapons exercises, which had been previously scheduled to take place later the year, as a warning to the West as the Ukraine crisis grows hotter. The massive drills of Russia's strategic nuclear forces will take place on Saturday. So a demonstration of power here by Putin. So be it. James says, change the course of time. I'm not sure if JF said that metaphorically, since he is talking about physics. No, I was talking about changing the course of history. I mean, you know, what are the chances that Ray Fleming is wrong? What are the chances that somehow in the little space between two protons, that somehow the Casimir effect is suspended? Chances are zero. Ray Fleming must be right. It's almost certain. What can you invoke? You would have to invoke special laws of physics. Suddenly, the Casimir effect, everything we've done with the plates doesn't work with protons for some reason. There's no reason that it wouldn't work. And so it's like, I'm in front of this work and I'm like, so in 100 years from now, it will be acknowledged that Ray Fleming was right about this, certainly. Probably about all of the rest. So that's what I mean by changing the course of time, the course of history. It's like in 100 years, the guy we just spoke to will have to be acknowledged as the discoverer of the nuclear Casimir effect, period. There is no other course possible. This guy got it because it's impossible that two things can be that close at exactly that distance range and not generate the Casimir force. But if it's a Casimir force, if it's a Casimir force that holds the nucleus together, then so much is wrong with our conceptions of particles and our standard model. The standard model just crumbles. And, you know, here we are. We just spoke to the guy. This guy has the right idea. How did it take an audience member to write to me, JF, you have to check out Ray Fleming? How do I not hear Lawrence Krauss and all these mainstream physicists? How do they not talk about it? Because there is no other path to the universe going forward than one in which people recognize that the Casimir effect must be the explanation for the strong force. Not bosons being bombarded, not bizarre particles being exchanged, not gluons. The thing I'm wondering about is if somehow the kind of force transmission through bosons and stuff like this, if it can be recuperated. I wonder. That's one question. Maybe we'll have Ray Fleming again in the future, and I'll ask him that. Is it possible that, let's say, that his Casimir effect of the nucleus model works? Is it still possible to somehow see the Casimir effect as transmitted by a molecule, even if it's not? Like, is it by a particle, even if it's not? In other words, is the standard model wrong at the fundamental, but right in a way? Like, can it be made to be right? Amalgam Zero says, brilliant. Yeah, he picked up where Lawrence Krauss left off. Firestarter says, should we teach our children the Fleming theory and not the mainstream? Well, certainly, if you reach a certain level of physics education in your children, and they are up to the point where they would be able to understand Hawking radiation, Casimir effect, it's certainly very easy to suggest to your children, look, there's this guy who has this theory of the nucleus, and to me that sounds right, even if you won't see it in your textbook. James says, yes, he should be a regular guest. What else did I want to talk about? At least 10 states pondering over 40 bills, tightening voter ID requirements. Well, those are some of the Republican states that are taking action to secure more seriously, although, you know, secure the election, that's a term that's been used by the Democrats, and they meant some specific things in that way. Yes, there will be some Republican states that are looking into truly securing the election. Lapitop sends a Richard Feynman video. He says, I found the video where he talks about this. Somehow the sound is not transmitting. Let's see. Let's try to fix the sound here. Input.
Last time, just to impress you with the speed at which mathematical symbols can convey, can carry information. We said that the force was proportional to the product of the masses of two objects and inversely is the square of the distance between them, and that bodies react to forces by changing their speeds or changing their motions in the direction of the force by amounts proportional to the force and inversely proportional to their masses. Now, that sounds, that's words, all right, and I didn't have to write the equation, but nevertheless, it's kind of mathematical, and we would wonder, how can this be a fundamental law? How can this planet out there look, what does it do to it? It looks at the sun, and it sees how far away it is, and it decides to calculate on its internal adding machine the inverse of the square of the distance, and that tells it how much to move. This is certainly no explanation of the machinery of gravitation.
That's brilliant, and I think Ray would totally agree with what was just said here. The descriptive theories of gravity have a complete failure in terms of fundamental mechanistic explanation, and that is where science lies. You know, science can either describe or it can describe the mechanism. Science is somewhere in the space between these two, and certainly when we look at a theory as scientists and we're like, oh, I'm satisfied, oh, that is powerful, it's mostly a mechanical theory that we mean. A descriptive theory, like the equation that's written on the board there, is merely telling you what's happening, what you observed.
So you might want to look further. And various people have tried to look further. Newton was originally asked, it doesn't mean anything, it doesn't tell us anything. He says, it tells you how it moves. It should be enough, I told you how it moves, not what. But people are often unsatisfied without a mechanism, and I would like to describe one theory which has been invented for, as a, among others, of the type that you might want, that this is the result of large numbers. And that's why it's mathematical. And I give this theory, perhaps you've thought of it yourself. Every once in a while, some student comes running in, he suddenly explains gravitation. Suppose that in the world, everywhere, there are flying through us at very high speed a lot of particles that come equally in all directions. They're just shooting by, shooting by, shooting by, and once in a while hit us in a bombardment. But we and the sun are practically transparent for them, nearly. But some hit, and so it's not completely transparent. Then look what would happen. If the sun is here and the earth is here, then if the sun weren't here, there would be particles bombarding from all sides, giving little impulses by the rattle of these bang, bang, the few that hit, which would put, not shake the earth in any particular direction, because there is many coming from one side as the other, from top, from bottom. However, when the sun is here, the particles which are coming in this direction are partly absorbed by the sun because some of them hit the sun and don't go through. Therefore, the number that are coming from this direction toward the earth is less than the number that are coming from the other side, because here they have no opposition from no sun there. And it's easy to see, after some mental effort, that the further the sun is away, the less in proportion of all of the particles are being taken out of the possible directions in which particles can come. I mean, the solar size appears smaller. And in fact, inversely is the square of the distance. So there will therefore be an impulse toward the sun on the earth that's inversely is the square of the distance and is the result of large numbers of very simple operations, just hit.
Yeah, I mean, Ray describes all of this theory and the presentation of Feynman in his book.
One after the other, from all directions. And therefore, the strangeness of the mathematical relation will be very much reduced because the fundamental operation is much simpler than calculating the inverse of the square of the distance. This machine does the calculating, these particles bouncing. Only trouble with it is that it doesn't work for other reasons. Every theory that you make up has to be analyzed against all the possible consequences and to see if it predicts anything else. And this predicts something else. If the Earth is moving this way, more particles will hit it from the front than from the back. If you're running in the rain, more rain hits you in the front of the face than in the back of the head because you're running into the rain. And so as the Earth is moving in this direction, it's running into the particles rather and running away from the ones that are chasing it from behind so that more particles hit it from the front than from the back. And there would be a force also sideways whenever there was any motion. This sideways force would slow the Earth up in the orbit and certainly would not have left.
Well, interestingly, very interestingly, what he's describing there is not very different from the mechanism of inertia. You know, what is inertia? Inertia is a rain that you face as you advance more. That you face as long as you're trying to advance more. And so, yeah, I would say under the theory of Ray, that takes the role of the inertia generating rotational zeptons. So if when you start to advance, you have zeptons and your field, suppose you were a charged particle trying to advance in a wire, let's say you're an electron. As you advance in the wire, there would be zeptons around the wire. And if you're negative, of course, you would attract the positive pole of the zeptons. And as you advance, the positive pole of the zepton will be rotated. So a movement advancing corresponds to a rotation of the zepton in that sense. This explains the right-hand rule of electromagnetism. You have a current going that way, you have a rotation of the magnetic field going that way. In Ray's theory, there is another form of rotational zeptons. It is the rotational zeptons of the matter field. And as matter advances, it has to rotate, and therefore it has to lose energy to these zeptons, which Ray uses to explain inertia. So I don't see in the rain ID that Richard Feynman is presenting, he may have been unintentionally essentially developing a theory of inertia.
Lasted the at least 3-4 billion years.
Well, and yes, so Lapitop says inertia is resistance against acceleration, though he's talking about resistance against velocity here. Yes, but that's the other subtlety of Ray's theory. It's that Ray's theory is not that there's a rain of photon coming from all of the universe. Ray's theory is that as you are advancing through the quantum field. Now, the quantum field is not a rain that comes at you more because you advance more. The quantum field simply needs to be rotated more as you advance more. So it has a different feature in that you wouldn't expect it to necessitate, you wouldn't expect velocity in and of itself to be pushing against you. You would expect it to simply require energy as you increase the rotation of the quantum dipoles.
It has been going around the sun. So that's the end of that theory. Well, you say that was a good one, though. It got rid of the mathematics for a while. Maybe I can invent a better one. And maybe you can, because nobody knows the ultimate. But up to today, from the time of Newton, no one has invented another theoretical description of the mathematical machinery behind this law, which does anything else but say the same thing over again or make the mathematics harder, and at the same time doesn't produce some wrong phenomenon. I mean, they have, like, this model does it, but it produces something which isn't true. So there is no model of the theory of gravitation today other than the mathematical form.
Very interesting. Thank you for sending me that link. It was beautiful to see Feynman's talent at explaining these things. He was really a great guy. Carlos says, the Earth isn't moving fast enough for Feynman to be correct here. I think Ray's onto something here. Yeah, and there are all sorts of considerations that Ray gives to this kind of characterization. Ultimately, it boils down, I believe, to the Michelson-Morley experiment, where they tried to detect the background ether. Like, is the planet moving into some media? And if the planet is moving into some media or has some relative speed with respect to some media, some medium, they expected somehow in their experiment that if you send a ray of light and you make it bounce and you make it come back, it should be affected differently if it's going through a medium with which you have a relative speed. So I think it boils down to this, and Ray has his own explanation of why the assumptions behind that experiment are wrong. So that is it for tonight, boys. Thank you so much for joining us. And what do we have on the schedule? Let's have a look at our schedule. So will be covering the news. Tomorrow I'll probably be doing 7 p.m. Eastern time, and then Sunday it's uncertain, but it will be 7 or 9, and then we'll go back to 7 p.m. Eastern time for sure at the beginning of the week. So that is it for tonight. Thank you so much for joining us, and I will see you all tomorrow. Thank you.